This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, filling in for Terry Gross. Thumbsucker is the first film directed by our guest Mike Mills, but you've probably already seen some of his work. He's directed commercials for Nike, Levi's, Volkswagen, and MasterCard. He did the Gap khaki commercial inspired by West Side Story, and he's done a number of music videos and album covers. Mills grew up in a home in which design and painting were very important. His father directed an art museum in Santa Barbara, and his mother sold Vera scarves and was a contractor and architect. Terry spoke with Mike Mills last fall when Thumbsucker was in theaters. The film is adapted from a Walter Kern novel and has just come out on DVD. It stars Vincent D'Onofrio, Tilda Swinton, and Lou Pucci. Pucci plays a 17-year-old high school student who still sucks his thumb out of insecurity. His guidance counselor has an idea. She thinks he has attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and suggests medication. In spite of his mother's skepticism, he begins the pills, and the transformation is amazing. He has more energy and focus and is relatively self-assured. Here he is with the school's debate coach, played by Vince Vaughn.
How are you doing with the medication?
I read Moby Dick straight through.
That's great. But how do you feel?
I feel like me. I never really did before.
Have you had any other breakthroughs besides the book?
It used to be kind of a hassle to put on underwear in the morning, but now it's kind of easy. Yeah. I actually listened to the words to the Pledge of Allegiance today, and they gave me chills.
I've always felt that you have a real sensitivity when it comes to language. And I know that you're smart. I think that you see a lot more than you take responsibility for. And that kind of perception that you have, that can't be taught by anyone. Rebecca left the debate team. Did she say anything to you about why or?
No.
Well, I need somebody to step up and take her place. I'd like for you to compete with us.
You think I could do it?
Yes, I do.
That's a scene from Mike Mills' new movie, Thumbsucker. Mike Mills, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Now,
the main character in Thumbsucker can't stop sucking his thumb, even though he's a teenager on the verge of going into college. Is there anything you relate to about that?
Well, I didn't suck my thumb, but I had all the anxiety. It might have been a good thing if I did suck my thumb. I might have been able to soothe myself a little bit. But beyond that, it's not like I had any of these kind of tics or these sort of mannerisms, but I so much relate to that Justin character, and it became a very personal project for me writing through him.
You know, it's funny, I know that you were also a skateboarder as a teenager, and I would think that as a skateboarder, you would have had like your crowd, and you would have been assertive in your own way, and that it would have been different for you than the kid in the film.
Skateboarding now is quite a trendy, it's a great way to get a girlfriend, to be a skateboarder now. Skating, when I was really doing it, when I was competing in it, was really just the biggest bunch of misfits you ever met. And, you know, all the people who couldn't find a place in the rest of the world found it in skateboarding. So we were all, you know, very disenfranchised from any sort of friendliness or any sort of feeling of like, you know, we've made it.
You know, the teenager in your movie is having a lot of troubles, and he's diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactive disorder and is given pills for it, and he desires to take the pills, and it really changes him. I mean, suddenly he's like more focused, he's more successful, he's more aggressive, and in some ways he's more obnoxious. Did you have much experience with pills like that, either taking them or watching friends who did?
Not at that age. You know, I'm 39. And I do feel like a lot of that, you know, the medication of, you know, the introduction of pharmacology into the high school wasn't really there when I was there, or maybe it was and I just didn't know about it. But it's funny, when we're doing the film, we would go around to high schools looking for locations, and of course I had to go try to find a nurse office that was right for us. And then they say, well, do you want to see where we keep the meds? And I was like, sure. And we open the door, and there's probably 100 bottles, you know, at each public high school we looked at. And I thought, wow, that's stunning. That's so unlike my world and the world that I knew. And maybe that's part of why I find it interesting, or, you know, it's in the book, but it's definitely something that I find so contemporary.
Now, I know that skateboarding has been a big part of your life, both as a skateboarder, but also as an artist. Some of the first work you did related to skateboards. You designed your own skateboards, and you designed logos for, or graphics, I should say, for those skateboards. So what kind of art did you design for your skateboards when you were a teenager?
Funnily enough, this kind of fits the Justin character. So when I was in high school, I actually made some skateboards in my wood shop, as ridiculous as it is. And I would get lots of blank boards because I knew people in different companies and I could get blank boards. But I was trying to make them all look adult and official and legitimate, you know? They weren't underground or punk in any way. I was actually trying to look sort of corporate or, like, real, you know? And then later on, you know, in a funny way, skating kind of came back in my mid to late 20s when I started doing designs for companies like Stereo, which is a skate company, or Supreme, which is a shop in New York. And that way, sort of, that's, I think, what people associate me with the skate culture. But it really is funny. I'm doing the same thing I did when I was 14, 15 years old.
When you're actually doing it for real and getting paid for it, did you still feel that they should look like official corporately made skateboards, or did you try to make them more unusual?
Well, funnily, and I really put all this together, my whole way of dealing with punk rock, like as an adult, has been sort of to really look at the cliches of punk rock, because by the time I'm 30, punk rock is sort of a cliche, CBGBs, Mohawks, whatever you want to call it, sort of a ripped and torn culture is sort of what you expect. So I often play with doing things very straight, very almost corporate looking, as a subversion of what you expect from punk rock. I did a Sonic Youth cover once that was had a picture of their merchandising shirt on the front, and everything about it was very regular and straight, and in a way just trying to flip what you'd expect from them. And same thing I did with Supreme. I did things that were very neat and regular and plain. And it was, again, it just felt wrong for what you would expect from that culture, from that person, from the kid wearing that shirt on the street. It felt wrong, and that's why I liked it. And to me, that is the excitement I got out of punk in the first place, was that wrongness, that incongruity, that sort of banana peel under people's expectations.
You came to art through what you were doing in punk music and in skateboarding. Your father was the director of an art museum in Santa Barbara. He was in the high art world. Did you relate to that world when you were growing up?
Not at all. I hated it. You know, the worst thing to do is have to go to the museum. It was a pain in the ass. And we had to do it all the time and go to these openings. And my father was sort of like a social king, and he had to talk to everybody. And trying to get my father to leave any party or leave the museum was this endless Kafkaesque, you know, oh, he's never going to leave, you know. So it was a pain, and they were very social. My parents, they had parties, you know, probably every 2 weeks, like 100 people over at the house. And there'd be all these strange, you know, characters that drank too much and were lurking around the house. And my impression of the whole thing was like, these people are just nuts, you know, and this whole thing is nuts. And it's your parents, you know, it's the last thing you're going to identify with. And I used to have to, they would make me take these after school art classes or art clinics because, you know, you're the art museum director's son, you have to support the arts. And luckily, I did have a thing about drawing, but it was largely against my will, participating in all these kind of formal things. And I didn't come around to art. See, you know, all the art I was doing is like, you know, posters for my band, stuff around skating. And, you know, my parents really, they encouraged me, but they didn't really, it wasn't art, you know. And to me, it certainly wasn't their art. And there's this gap between me and them. And when I had that, you know, epiphany at 17, 18, they're like, oh man, I'm not going to be a professional skateboarder. I suddenly, you know, had to go over. I remember one time asking my dad, okay, Pop, tell me about 20th century art. And then it was this seminal moment in our relationship where I caved in and kind of went over to his side.
And did you like the art world any better when you were in art school?
I did at first, and I, you know, I loved so many people I went to school with, and I was so amazed by them and influenced by them. Cooper Union at the time was a strange place to go to school. It had all, like, the emotional warmth of, like, the Port Authority, you know? There's no, like, there's no counselors. There's no dorms. You live at the 92nd Street Y. And my freshman year, someone shot a BB gun at someone else in a critique, and someone else beat someone else up, and, you know, it's... But, you know, we had a great time. And then one of my biggest teachers, the person that influenced me the most, is a man named Hans Hacke, who's, you know, a conceptual political artist who does lots of work about the institutions of art and the kind of duplicities of it. So, you know, all my teenage rebellion from art all of a sudden got a new father figure who gave me rational, justified opinions of why I should hate art again, you know? And, eventually led me and a lot of my friends were kind of just, you know, this is the 80s art world, Mary Boone Gallery blowing up, people like Julian Schnabel are huge. We're all feeling a little, you know, disillusioned. And a lot of us got into graphics or anything like that because the money was up front. It's obviously crass. And because you're more in the public sphere. And I remember the first time I saw one of my posters wheat pasted on Broadway, I thought, oh, I made it. You know, I am not in the rarefied world of art. I am participating in the world with people and I'm in the real world, you know?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that you put it that way because, I mean, you're talking about the gallery scene, the painting scene in the 80s as having this, like, really unpleasant business underside, that where money was really important and there was plenty of it. At the same time, you went on to do commercials, and two of your best known commercials are Gap commercials for khakis, and these were the two, like, West Side Story commercials. One was choreographed to Cool, and the other to the Mambo from the Dance at the Gym. And I mean, they're really catchy commercials, but they're commercials. And I know, like, when I was coming of age, the idea of doing commercials seemed so, well, commercial. You know,
exactly.
If you did commercials, you were selling out. Whereas now with commercials, I mean, bands break records in commercials. Bands get discovered in commercials. I mean, commercials are considered, like, much more hip and less strictly just about money. So where did you see yourself fitting in there? What did doing commercials mean to you?
Yeah, well, it's a very complicated road that I don't have resolved, and I think it's one of the more interesting problems of being some sort of, whatever you want to call it, artist-type person who's trying to have a larger audience than the art world provides. And our problem with the art world wasn't that it involved money, but that it hid the money, and it pretended that it was all about sort of an auteur definition of the artist and his creativity and his mind, and that somehow it was above and beyond, you know, human duplicities. And then when you work for a printmaker and you see that, you know, I did, there's a very famous artist I won't name, and I worked for a printmaker, and he came in one morning really hungover, sketched out his wood print, the wood block that he wanted on a napkin, tossed it to me. I cut the whole thing out, you know, blew it up to the size we want, executed the whole thing. We printed it up. Someone from the Brooklyn Museum came by and said, look at the maturity in the handwork and the beauty. and you can clearly see his I'm going to give it away, partly his Scottish roots and da-da-da. And I just was like, oh, my God, this is, you know. And to be honest, it's like my parents again, reminding me of all the things that you don't like about your parents. And so anyways, we just didn't like that it was hiding the money and that it was hiding, it was, you know, mythologizing things that weren't really true. So that's kind of what got us into wanting just the money to be, you know, the crassness of it to be more exposed, more transparent, more on the surface. And I should say, it's not like what I'm saying is right, you know? This is me at 20, you know what I mean? That was my thinking at 20, 21, and what we were trying to do, and as imperfect as it was, that was our thinking at the time. And then getting into ads, you know, it's a funny thing. Like what you said before about how ads are now hip and not, you know, sort of perceived as not selling out is, I think, exactly why they're so dangerous, even to filmmakers like myself. And in the ad world, you're treated like a king as a director. The director is really overvalued. and you're kind of led to believe that you are making art, that you're not making commerce. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if you didn't go to film school and you don't know how to operate a crew, you haven't done anything, and you have some want to practice, you know, and art school does develop this idea that you should practice your craft, or you need to practice to get a certain level. I mean, me and a lot of people I knew did ads as kind of like going to film school or as a way to learn, because it's so expensive, you're going to learn on someone else's dime. And I remember one of the first big ads I did was for Nike, and I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what a medium shot and a wide shot and a tight shot was. And I remember like 2 days before the shoot, I went into the accountant at the production company because I knew that he wouldn't tell anybody. And I said, Tom, is a medium shot where it's like from your head to your waist, you know? And so what's a tight shot from your head to your mid chest? And then you can just cut them together and it'll work. And he's proudly telling me because, you know, the director's asking him a question. And I went and shot it the next day, you know? So I really felt like I was getting one over on the man, you know, and that I was being Robin Hood and I was taking the money I was earning and I was paying for my short films and documentaries and I was making it so that I could do art in a gallery and not have any need to make any money off of it, you know. And at the same time, I thought I was being somehow subversive by being out in the public and that level being, you know, that hugely exposed and at the same time having a gallery show about death, you know. And I thought, oh, I'm interesting.
As a teenager, you were into skateboarding. Do you still ever do it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't skate all the time, but I definitely still skate. This is a funny image for you. My skateboard is in the back of my, you know, Volvo station wagon. That's who I am now. That's what I've become. But, you know, there's some parks around that I like to go to and sort of skate in a very retired-like fashion, you know.
What design is on your skateboard?
I got this one. It's kind of totally unlike me. I got it when we're shooting the film. It's from a shop up in Portland, and it's like black with a skull on it. It's completely like my taste. But there you go. You can't control everything.
I bet it looks great in the station wagon.
Yeah.
Mike Mills, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a real honor being on your show.
Mike Mills, speaking with Terry Gross. His first feature film, Thumbsucker, has just been released on DVD.